This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents an interview with Sidney Poitier. His last book, The Measure of a Man, won the 2000 Grammy Award for Best Spoken Word Album. Both The Measure of a Man and Mr. Poitier's latest book, Life Beyond Measure, are available as downloadable audiobooks. This is Michael Conroy from Harper Audio, and I have the honor today of speaking with Mr. Sidney Poitier about his book, The Measure of a Man. The Grammy Award-winning audiobook of The Measure of a Man, read by its author, is published by Harper Audio. Good morning.
Good morning.
The Measure of a Man is your second book dealing with your life. It's not quite an autobiography entirely, but it's your second autobiography. What prompted you to write this, as you called it, a spiritual autobiography?
Well, I suppose it was the fact that I didn't say all that I had to say or could have said at that time. I felt a need to articulate certain aspects of my life that was not covered in the autobiography.
And what were those aspects? Was it just this, your spiritual journey, your journey through life as a spiritual person, or?
Well, we all journey through life on a spiritual level, but the word spiritual means different things to different people. So the second book had to do with certain drives that were present in my life from the very beginning, meaning from the very, as far back as I can remember. They were driving forces, and these driving forces were the foundation of everything I did in life.
Speaking of foundations, one of the themes that runs through the book is, you come back to it often, bloodlines, the foundations that parents lay down for their children. What legacies did you receive from your parents and other ancestors and forebears, and what legacies do you hope to have passed on to your children?
What I got from my parents was a collection of impressions that were registered by my consciousness, my awareness as a child. I interpreted these impressions automatically. For instance, my mother was treated in a certain way by my father. As long as I can remember, when I was a child, until I left them and went to Florida, I always remembered how he treated her. He treated her wonderfully well. He was a very kind person to my mother, and she to him. Now, we lived on an island where there were just 900 people on the entire island, and the island was 46 miles long and 3 to 4 miles wide. It could have held as many people as are presently in New York City in terms of the land area. But there was just a very small number of people on the island. So on Cat Island, which was one of the settlements on the island, Arthurstown is where we lived. And Arthurstown was one of the very few sparsely spotted townships. In our township, there was probably 100, maybe 150 people. So neighbors were not clustered. They were distant. There was the average neighbor to us was my grandparents on my mother's side, and they were walking distance about 150, 200 yards. Other neighbors were a quarter of a mile, some 2 miles away. So the relationship I had with my parents was one of observation. My relationship with them was one of experiencing who they were and how they were. And my friends in school and the other neighbors in the township, I learned from how people dealt with each other. That was the only way I could learn. Those things were not taught in school. So I developed, accumulated over time, a number of observations that I took unto myself. And over time, I began to behave in ways that were passed on to me, not verbally, not only in terms of behavior.
And is that how you pass those things along then to your children, just by example and with the hope that that bloodline continues into your own children's lives?
No. By the time that I was an adult person, I had had many experiences. I had had infinitely a more varied experience than had my parents in their entire lifetime, because I moved from Cat Island to Nassau, which was the capital city of the Bahamas. And from there, by the age of 15, I found myself in Miami, Florida, where, incidentally, I was born, to my parents, who were tomato farmers, who were delivering their tomato crop to the wholesalers in Florida, to whom they sold annually their produce. But anyway, at the age of 15, I left the Bahamas and went to Florida, which was a very new experience for me. So from Florida on, I was exposed to a new culture and trying to effectuate my survival within the context of this new culture. I had only what I had observed and learned from my parents, my neighbors, my siblings, the other children and their parents with whom I had contact. But I left Cat Island at the age of 10 and a half, spent 3.5 years in Nassau, and then at 15, I found myself in Florida. And what I carried with me from the 10 and a half years on Cat Island and the few years in Nassau was the accumulated experiences and observations that made up who I was. I didn't know much else because I didn't have the kind of education that would allow me to explore, to imagine, and to decipher on any really level of depth my life or my parents' lives or whatever. I knew very little. What could a kid who had a very limited education by then and who could hardly read, who had no knowledge that there was an outside world. I'd never had the experience of seeing an electric light or an automobile or what a paved road was. Didn't know there were such things as toilets inside of homes. I mean, it was a semi-primitive existence for me for 10 and a half years. And then, of course, the few years in Nassau, where there was a more sophisticated community. Nassau was another island, the capital island of the Bahamas, and things were somewhat different. There was electric lights, and there were automobiles, and there were all kinds of things. And there was a representative number of white people in Nassau, where there was not really on Cat Island. There were only 2 out of the 900 people on the whole island that I knew of. And it was a totally different society. As a matter of fact, I found myself having to sharpen my observations in order just to understand the moment in which I would find myself. So I became a person who began to articulate himself in that manner. I would look and I would see and I would try to understand with the limited experiences that I had had, try to understand what made people deal with each other in the manners in which they did. And that was this new culture. This new culture was, for instance, it was a culture that required me to ride in the back of the bus. And I never knew what that was like. And therefore, I didn't understand it. And I had to observe to try to understand it. The relatives with whom I lived, that my father had sent me to, to live with because he wanted to get me out of the environment in Nassau. They were accustomed to riding in the back of the bus. I was not. I had no intercourse with race and the attendant requirements that race placed on one, whether white or black. And I was confused. So I brought to bear, in terms of understanding, I brought to bear the same mechanism I used in the Bahamas. I looked and I listened and I observed and I sensed and I registered and stuff like that.
All those things that are sort of possible because you have, or maybe made more possible by the fact that you are an outsider in that situation. You come back to that theme of being an outsider throughout the book. How has that, outside of causing you these keener observations as you moved through these new environments, how has being an outsider, even through your life today, the way you describe it in the book, how has that affected your journey of understanding, as you put it forth in The Measure of a Man?
Well, my whole life was that of an outsider for many, many, many years. I was quite an adult person before I began to see that I was acclimatizing myself to being a participant in the social structure of this new society. I was an outsider because I was an outsider. When I got to Nassau from Cat Island, I arrived totally untutored in the ways of that society, which was quite close to what we had on Cat Island, but yet different. So I was an outsider in Nassau, and I was an outsider in Miami, Florida, and I wound up in New York City at the age of 16. And I was an outsider in New York City. So let me explain to you what I felt of being an outsider was. I was not a part of the process. I had not been molded. I had not been shaped. I had not been addressed and prepared to fit into what I found. I left Cat Island with a sense of myself. A sense of myself that I had gathered from how I saw my parents and other people treated each other. So I tried getting away, and I wound up ultimately in New York. And there I was an outsider because though things were somewhat different, essentially they were, for the most part, the same. And so it continued in that way through my life, my young adult life, certainly. But that is how I learned what I know about life and living. I didn't learn it in school because I never returned to school. I learned it in the first 10 and a half years. I had no idea at 10 and a half that I was operating on instinct, on curiosity, on other of those internal forces that make up my personality and also make up my consciousness. Those were the things. Curiosity drew my attention to something or some circumstance or some individual or some creature or some elemental system in terms of weather or in terms of storms. My curiosity was at work and my instincts were at work. But I didn't know that there was a word, the word curiosity. I didn't know what it meant then, but it was at work in me. I didn't know what instincts were, but they were at work in me. Am I making any sense to you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm drawn to think of the stories in The Measure of a Man about the choices that you made once you were beginning your career as an actor. And you made some very interesting choices based on strength of character, things that you were willing to do and weren't willing to do. You recount those stories in the book. And it all seems to come back maybe to those 10 and a half years or to your role as an outsider, that you were able to, you had a sense of yourself and were able to make decisions based on that sense of yourself as opposed to other factors that might have been involved in those kind of decisions.
Well, yeah, I think that that is correct. The principal approach to everything I did was because I arrived in Florida, already with a sense of myself. You see?
Absolutely.
I did not know that being, that the color of my skin had a characterization other than it being a natural situation. And I had no idea about that. But I was fortunate enough to live for 10 and a half years, the first 10 and a half years of my life, and never having had to make an adjustment based on the color of my skin.
Right.
So that by the time I got to Nassau, when colonialism was the first thing I had to adjust to, and then I got to Florida, where race was a strong factor, I was already molded in a way. I had already accepted myself, received myself, viewed myself, and conducted myself as a person. I knew I didn't have much of an education, but I had these other things working for me that I couldn't even articulate then, you know. I had the curiosity then. I had good instincts then.
Right.
I had a fair sense of right and wrong then. So that when I got to Florida, those forces kicked in automatically once I found myself in a situation that was trying to impose on me a definition of self that was contrary to who I was or who I had become in the first 15 years of my life.
At what point in your life were you able to recognize these patterns? You've talked about how they were instinctual, but you had no words for them. But at what point in your life were you able to see the patterns and see the influences of your life on Cat Island or in Cat Island and your parents in the Bahamas and how colonialism, how all these things had grown, put together to make you into the man that you are? When were you able to see that?
I began to see that when I was in New York City, around about 16. I found that I had such, my educational background was so sparse that I realized when I could not, in many instances, I could not understand or read or translate the names of streets if they were not digital. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
I knew where 125th Street was in New York. If you put numbers to it, I would know and would recognize it. But if you put a name, particularly a three-syllable word or four-syllable word, I wouldn't know what it meant because I didn't read that well. As a matter of fact, my reading throughout my life until then was operative in the following manner. In my schooling in Nassau for 2.5 years before I quit and went to work as a day laborer, I had a great teacher that I remember even to this day. I could see the features of his face. And he introduced me for the first time to words come in syllables sometimes. There are 2 syllables, 3 syllables, and more. And to understand just the pronunciation of the word, one has to deal with the syllables. And he taught me how to do that. So that when I got to New York and I remembered his teachings, I began to do that with street signs that I couldn't read what the word meant. Well, I couldn't understand what the word meant, but I would be able to break it down in syllables. And then I found it necessary to do the same. In order to find jobs, I had to go to the newspapers. And in going to the newspapers, I would haltingly stumble through the want-ad pages looking for dishwasher jobs. And that was the beginning of my recognition that I had to learn to read very well in order to effectuate my survival in this new society. I was no match for it. It would grind me up and spit me out. Unless I could put my thoughts and my feelings into words, if I could at least know how to respond to this social structure, if I could read better. So I decided that that is exactly what I needed to do. And it wasn't overnight. It was a very long time. As a matter of fact, I went into the theater by accident, and all because I was looking for a dishwashing job in a newspaper. Anyway, so...
But then you ended up in the theater and in acting and the movies. And it's interesting that you ended up a place where you're dealing with words and feelings and all that stuff and reading scripts. I mean, just... it's a fascinating story that you tell in The Measure of a Man. Throughout the book, you return to that idea of the measure of a man, not as the title, but just your father's definition of the measure of a man when you first get to America, people who are taking your measure, your own perceptions. In the end, what do you think is the measure of a man and his life lived?
Well, my father felt it, and he passed it on to his sons, and I was the last of his sons. He told us once that, and he behaved it in everything he did. He said, the measure of a man is how well he cares for his children. And that's how he lived his life. And that is how I lived my life with my children. I have six children, and I have lived my life to now in terms of my children exactly that way. I have tried my best to take care of my children in every way. Forget food and shelter, but in terms of ideas and ideals and values and stuff like that. But I now see and feel that there is more that articulates a man, you know, in any social structure. It is the values he holds and the values he will defend and protect and nurture, and among them are character and honesty, fairness, compassion, all kinds of things I knew about instinctively, but I didn't know what their names were.
Right. Well, I think that is a perfect place to end the interview. That's a lovely thought to end on. So I'd just like to say thank you so much for taking time out of your day to talk to us about these ideas and the ideas that you present in The Measure of a Man. It's a terrific book, and I'm sure that everyone who reads it or listens to it will get something very valuable from it. Thank you again.
I thank you, sir.
We hope you've enjoyed this interview with Sidney Poitier. If you would like to hear more, you can download his audiobooks, The Measure of a Man and Life Beyond Measure, published by Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.